Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Knoll. This is the Progressive Commentary Hour. Today, our theme, Google, its real agenda, and one person who decided he had had enough, and he wanted to speak out. Here's the problem. When the story was available to a major news source, they declined to air the program, to do the interview. What were they afraid of? Was it because they had been threatened that if they did do a program with a whistleblower from Google, that Google may delist them, meaning you wouldn't be able to get any research results that would support you? To unravel this is the person who was able to do the interview with our source. She is Helen Beniski. She has worked on major investigative reports as a journalist activist, and she's with us now on the line. Nice to have you with us today, Helen.
Good to be here, Gary.
And Helen is a researcher and editor at RTV in New York. Tell us briefly about who this person is and what we expect to hear in the upcoming interview that we're airing exclusively here on the Progressive Commentary Hour.
Well, Zach Voorhees was an engineer at Google for 8 years. First, he worked on Google Earth, and then he was with YouTube. But basically, he leaked about 1,000 pages of documents, and these are really like insider stuff that really shows the true agenda of Google. And it's not, I mean, I hate to be the spoiler, but it's not to be the world's best search engine. They have a little bit bigger aspirations than that. But what I found to be really disturbing is that plenty of media organizations were willing to post excerpts from some of the documents, like some of the early documents. He did a little teaser when he was still anonymous before he came out and revealed his identity and who he was, which should have just authenticated the documents because obviously he's worked there for almost a decade. But instead, when he revealed himself, the media just got cold feet. Some Daily Beast reporter dug up some old tweets, and because he had some opinions that maybe are controversial, they just decided that they would just, you know, ignore the entire massive trove of documents that he had revealed. And even some alternative media organizations, which you would think would jump on this like hotcakes because they've been victimized by Google. It's not like these mainstream media smear jobs haven't been perpetrated on alternative media organizations. Everybody should have been clamoring to interview this guy, and nobody was. So I decided to do it. And what you'll hear is that really it's an important question of whether Google has had this plan all along to become the social engineer, to move society, to nudge society in its desired direction. Or whether this is just something that happened when it got all this power and realized, well, hey, we can accomplish something more than becoming just the world's best search engine. But the degree of power that Google has in our society is really disturbing. And as you'll hear, our whistleblower really tells us some things that should keep us awake at night, I think.
What are the major areas that we're going to be listening to?
Well, just that the Google search results are designed to not to show you how the world as it is, but to show you the world as Google wants it to be. So they have these algorithms called machine learning fairness that will say if you search CEOs, and in reality and in the world, there are more men than women who are CEOs, at least in the Western world. And so Google, because this is not fair, will populate the search results with a bunch of female faces. Now, it's debatable whether there should be more women CEOs in the world. That's a perfectly valid point of view to have. But it's not reality, and Google should be showing you the world as it is. It's a search engine. It's supposed to be doing that. But no, Google has this vision of itself as being the fixture of society. And it, basically, Zach Voorhees revealed is that kind of after the 2016 election, this social engineering thing really kicked into high gear. At least that's how he describes it, that all these psychology papers started appearing on the Google servers and people started having these conversations about how we really need to get everything back on the rails and we need to start suppressing these low-end news websites, which basically is code for any website that's outside the mainstream, whether it's to the right or to the left. I mean, a lot has been made of censorship of conservatives, but there's also plenty of censorship of those on the left, those progressive outlets like Progressive Radio Network. that don't embrace the mainstream democratic orthodoxy.
Okay. Well, Helen, let's go now to your interview with this gentleman, and hopefully it'll give us some new and important insights into the power of Google and their right to censorship.
Here with Zach Voorhees from Google. You are still with Google, correct?
Or have No, I resigned shortly before I came out.
Okay, good to know, good to know. And you were there for 8 years, right?
Yes, I was. I started off with Google Earth, and then I moved to YouTube for 3 years.
And you finished at YouTube, or you ended up at regular Google at some point, or?
Well, no. So I started off with Google, working for the Google Earth department, and I was with them for 5.5 years. And then I left Google to start my own company and then came back and worked at their YouTube division for 3 years.
Okay. And what you said you were motivated. I was listening to your interview with Project Veritas. You said you were motivated to come forward because of this whole machine learning fairness thing. Was there anything in particular, like one specific moment that made you just decide you didn't want to do this anymore, or?
So things just started to get really weird directly after Trump won the 2016 election. And I noticed that there was a bunch of weirdo psychology papers that started appearing on the network that was publicly available to any, you know, internal, to any employee. And I was like, what's going on here? I thought this company is about self-expression and expressing yourself. And now they're talking about fake news and, you know, boosting authoritative content. And they really had this emphasis on fake news. And it just kept on progressively getting worse. And the point that it got like too much to bear, and I realized that I really needed to do something, was when I caught Google deleting words out of their translation dictionary in order to make Trump tweets sound crazy.
You're talking about the COFEFE thing, right?
Yeah, that's correct.
Yeah, I noticed I was looking through the documents. I mean, you released hundreds of documents, and there's some really appalling stuff in there. But just in the space of like 2016 to 2017, Google goes from saying, well, we can't really decide what's fake news and what's not, to 2017, all of a sudden they're saying we are the authoritative source for what is true. And I mean, was there some sort of shift in management that made them just decide they were the rightful arbiters of truth, or?
No, there was no shift in upper management. And it was really weird because I remember like an article, you know, saying should like Twitter or Google like ban ISIS. And they were like, we can't apply censorship because that would set a dangerous precedent. And
yeah.
And now you say the wrong word. You say like Mitch McConnell posted a video of somebody giving him a death threat, and Mitch McConnell got banned. And so everything right now seems to be pretty much a clown world. And people have asked me like, how did this happen? Was there a change in management? And there was no change in management. And it's really interesting because like the CEO of YouTube, Susan Wojcicki, you know, she was saying these words like self-expression and we need to, you know, help the user express themselves through our platform, to completely doing a 180 and saying, you know, that we need to like start censoring all this stuff. And she didn't say the word censor. She kind of danced around that word, but, you know, prevent fake news from reaching our user base.
So what are we doing? Basically, this sounds easy, but it's really hard to do. We're pushing down the fake news, we're demoting it, and we are increasing the authoritative news and promoting it. How do we do that? We have a whole system. We came up with trashy news where we have build classifiers, we identify it, we look for salacious, for clickbait, content that isn't, that we don't think is the authoritative news. It's just kind of encouraging people to look at, but it's not true. We're training, we added these instructions to our raters, and we've updated our classifiers, and we are working to understand, identify that with machine learning, and then to push that down. And then we're increasing our authoritative news. We're doing that with things like a breaking news shelf. We're treating it in the U.S., in France, in the U.K., and more countries coming soon, where we have sources that come from reputable sources. We work with Google News on that to define what those reputable sources are. It triggered last week in the London Bridge attacks. It's also going to trigger on search. When you type in something, you're looking for a news event, you're going to see news there.
And, you know, the question is, how can these people, you know, go from believing one thing and then completely inverting and saying something else? And that's a really interesting question.
Yeah, it makes me wonder, like, is there this social engineering thing that was sort of underlying Google's mission from the beginning? Because you would think, I mean, a bunch of software engineers, they're mostly designed to do programming, and then suddenly they're programming humans instead of software. Like, was that always the goal? Or did they just suddenly realize, we have all this power, let's use it for good, or let's use it for what we think is good? Like, was this always the goal? Or do you think that this came later when they realized they had all this power?
Well, you know, it's interesting. My girlfriend, in like 2011 or 2012, she was from Ukraine, and she was Russian, Ukrainian Russian, and she told me that Google was going to become a really evil, evil company, and I fought with her on this. I was like, no, they're not going to be that. Like, you don't understand. This is like a great company, and she was 100% right. And the reason why she knew that this was the way it was going to be was because she had experienced all this, and she had experienced like the clown world, you know, firsthand, and had fled from it. And so she saw the patterns, and I didn't, because I was naive and I had never experienced something like this before. And so this is what happened. You know, they turned, and I think now looking back on it, that the goal of, you know, social media was to actually control society. And while the people that were running the company and above them had control of the country, they were going to give us our freedoms. But as soon as they lost control, that's when they started to use Google as a control mechanism to try to get that control back.
Yeah, because you get the sense that, I mean, they don't want to talk about it openly, but they're trying to nudge people's behavior in a certain direction. And I found it very interesting. I forget the name of the document, but there was one where they're talking about profiling people, basically putting them in categories. And they're very adamant about the fact that they don't want any of this saved to a hard drive. That's how sensitive the data is, where they're talking about basically putting people in demographic categories. And so, I mean, to what extent is this this algorithmic bias? They're creating the algorithmic bias so that they can save you from the algorithmic bias. I mean, in a sense, it's like the pyromaniac fireman. I mean, how close were you to this whole algorithmic bias, machine learning, fairness thing? Like, were you with the teams that were involved in that, or did you just see it? Or
no. So a lot of people assume that I was one of the operators or implementers of this, like, bias. And I want to clarify that I was not. I worked on the YouTube product that goes on televisions and game consoles. And I was, you know, I consider myself a liberal. Some people say that I'm right wing. Maybe liberalism is becoming more of a right wing ideal. But I saw what was happening, and I just started investigating. And that's all I did. And so I don't know the people who implemented it, and I don't know too deep knowledge of exactly how it works. My knowledge comes from the same documents that I've disclosed to everyone else.
Yeah, one thing I thought would be useful would be to have like a glossary for people who don't really either speak programming or speak Google. I mean, Google definitely has a language of its own. Like, have you considered maybe putting that out? Because some of the documents seemed like they were saying something very sinister, but it's impossible to tell if you don't know. I mean, for example, like what's a twiddler?
Yeah, so let me explain some of these terms. So under ML fairness, there's certain sub-projects that, you know, help it, you know, control and sculpt the information landscape. So Twiddler is one of those subsystems, and it manages real-time events and sees trends that are happening in real time, and then tries to, you know, amplify or dampen them. So for example, let's say that there's an earthquake that happens, then they're going to be able to respond to that in real time. And yeah, so that's what Twiddler is. And there's also another project called Purple Rain, kind of like the Prince song. And what it does is it's staffed 24/7, and they just monitor events that are happening. They decide whether they want to boost or, you know, dampen it down. And let's see. So we've got Twiddler, we've got Purple Rain, we've also got Superroot. So Superroot plugs into Twiddler. Superroot is the thing that is actually the ranking and deranking engine. And so Twiddler feeds into that, Purple Rain feeds into that, and then that thing is actually the thing that, you know, boosts certain content or dampens it.
And how many people are there that basically decide whether or not the content can be boosted, or how many people are there that decide what content can be put out in the aftermath of, say, a natural disaster or a mass shooting or something like that?
I'm not entirely sure. I think that the team is small. The total number of people that are working on various censorship projects is probably ranges in the thousands, because what they're doing is that they are training these machine learning algorithms with by tagging data, right? So if they go through and, like, there's a video a human reader can go through and say, oh, well, this is hate speech, right? And so what they're doing is that they're training the algorithms to identify certain patterns and key phrases to be hate speech, and then that goes into Superroot, which then, you know, boosts it up or dampens it down.
And as far as the hate speech goes, I mean, did you interface with the Jigsaw project at all? Their sort of experimental.
I did not, but I did have the pleasure of seeing their classification engine for YouTube videos, which was called Viacon. And Viacon does a classification based on the transliteration of the YouTube videos. So let's say you've got an influencer and he's talking about a certain topic. Well, what the AI is doing is that it's capturing all of that information and it's translating it into a text version of what the person's saying, and then data mining that for keywords, and then depending on those keywords, it then classifies the video under various tags. And then those tags are used to figure out whether the video should be branded as brand unsafe or demonetized, and under various conditions, those videos will then lose their opportunity to get the monetization during their search. And this is one of the real dark things, is that YouTube would demonetize videos during the first 6 hours, and then they would be, and then the content creator would send the video up for review, and a human reviewer would see the video and they say, oh yeah, this actually isn't brand unsafe. We're going to turn ads back on. But, you know, 80% of the views have already been lost for monetization. And then, you know, YouTube just kept on doing this, like video after video after video was demonetized during the first like 6 to 12 hours. And it was really destroying these content creators, you know, revenue source. So that's how it worked.
Yeah, I think that, YouTube and as like most of these social media platforms seem to be a kind of trap where they lure creators in and everybody gets on the one platform and then the door snaps shut and everybody's trapped in there and they no longer have their own independent platforms. But I know that one document a lot of people were talking about is this blacklist of terms that has basically 9 trillion different misspellings of every major mass casualty event in the last few years.
Isn't that weird? Isn't that weird?
It's so strange. Yeah, I mean, even words like New York City or the letter P or like, there's some really strange stuff on there. I mean, I had a whole list of them, but it ended up getting too long. I did not even bother. But so that's just if people type that whole phrase in, it sets off a censorship script, or is it an autocorrect thing, or I mean an autocomplete thing rather, or what is that?
Yeah, think about autocomplete, but for censorship, right? So someone types in a query for like Stephen Paddock. And the videos that related to that word were suppressed. And that's essentially what that blacklist is doing. You can also find that there's election interference in that Corey blacklist. You can see that they blacklisted the entire term, Eighth Amendment of the Constitution of Ireland. Okay, so people searching for information related to constitutional law in Ireland were blocked from doing so. And you got to ask yourself, why does Google care? There should be a search company. Why are they like, why have they elected themselves to be social engineers that are figuring out what information its users should and should not have access to?
It's a good question. And another thing that I think is really important is, I mean, isn't Google losing money by promoting these quote-unquote authoritative sources in YouTube? I mean, people go on YouTube because they want to see, like, independent media creators. They don't want to see CNN, and they don't want to see, like, the Ministry of Truth. They want to see people like themselves. I mean, is Google losing money on this? Or
They are. Like, I remember back in 2016... Google was talking about how they had this goal to get to 4 billion something. I can't remember if it was like watch hours or views in a day or something like that. But they said that they were at 1 billion and they were trying to quadruple it to 4 billion in like by end of the next year. And then 2016 happened, and the election happened in 2016, and they pretty much just like abandoned that entire mandate. And so they're losing money over it. Like they're literally abandoning their fiduciary responsibility to maximize shareholder profit so that they can be creepy social engineers. Like, what is going on here? Like, I thought that the primary functionality of a company was to maximize shareholder value. There's even a Supreme Court verdict that said that was what the company had to do. And here they are, like, abandoning it. And, you know, and then I realized that, you know, why don't the shareholders just force them to stop doing this? And then I go to their IPO and I realize that, oh, they've got two different classes of stock. And one class of stock, the insider stock, has like 10 times the voting rights. So even if the company, even if the founders completely, you know, sell out most of their stock, they can still effectively run the company. And even if most of the owners are other people, those owners don't have a say in how their company's being run. Like, something really like dark is going on here with their, like, now it's starting to look like they were planning this from the start, right? And when you look at their sort of their constitution, when they go IPO, they said, you know, we don't be evil and organize the world's information and make it universally accessible and useful. You know, I have to wonder whether that whole, you know, don't be evil wasn't a message, wasn't a commitment, but was a warning to themselves, you know? And, you know, who was that mission statement aimed towards? And so here we are, like, now Google is interfering in elections globally, and they're censoring keywords, and every you know, mass casualty event that's been has been rumored to be a false flag is in this YouTube query blacklist. And, you know, people searching for, well, is David Hogg a crisis actor? Well, they've got that in there as a query blacklist. So they're suppressing all of this information, you know, bombing, you know, from the Las Vegas shooting attack to bombings in New York. It's quite eye-opening, and that seems to be the most popular document that has been posted online.
Well, that's what it is. It's basically very sinister. I mean, do you know how quickly after these events these words get added to the blacklist? Because for such a blanket censorship to just censor the word New York City or Port Authority bus terminal, I mean, they're really, it's a very, very wide-ranging crackdown. They really don't want any information getting out about these things.
Yeah. So the question of how fast is it? How fast does it happen? Is a really good question. And my answer to that is it happens pretty immediately. I remember during the Las Vegas shooting attack, there was like this emergency, and Google and YouTube like sent a message to every single employee saying, oh my gosh, there's all this fake news that's being generated, all these conspiracy theories that's being generated by the Las Vegas shooting, and we need to, you know, make sure that those low quality search results don't make it to the general population. And so they had this mobilization of censorship, and all these blacklists started to appear. And what I noticed is that there was like collateral damage. There was websites that had nothing to do with any sort of fake news that were being added to this blacklist. And there's an Easter egg that's in the disclosure, and I'm asking your audience to go in and search for my name, Nidorus, and you're going to find something that's going to blow your mind. But I'm not ready to disclose what that is yet on air, because I want to give, you know, the different audiences that are listening to the interviews a chance to dive in and see what the collateral damage was that happened on October 2nd, 2017, during or right after the Las Vegas shooting attack.
Well, that's, yeah. So, audience, if you're listening, please go and look that up, because I know I've been looking through, I've made it through most of these documents, at least skimming them, but there's a lot to look through. And I mean, yeah, everybody sort of knew that Google was sinister and evil on some level by now, I think, if you've been paying attention. But this really, I mean, this is receipts. If you want receipts, this is receipts. Let's see. Another one of these documents that a lot of people were talking about is this blacklist of websites. Now, this is just websites being blacklisted from Google News, correct? This is not websites being blacklisted from search entirely, or is it?
There's a total of 11 blacklists that have been identified now. I've released two of them, and Robert Epstein, who is the former psychologist or chief editor for Psychology Today, he disclosed that there were 9 blacklists, and he wrote an in-depth article about those blacklists. And what's important about these blacklists is that there is collateral damage. There are websites that have nothing to do with the topic that they're censoring that are being added to these. In fact, it looks like they are legitimate URLs because they contain the keywords in the URL that that have to do with the fake news. But the surprising thing is that the websites, they don't have that URL. They don't have that article. And sometimes they have double subdomains in the links. And so the whole website gets taken down. They have no idea. They have no idea why or what the reason is. And then they go to Twitter and they complain about it, and they get nowhere. There's no way that they can get unblacklisted. And this collateral damage is the way that, you know, insiders that have knowledge of Google's internal vulnerabilities that Google refuses to fix, they're able to stuff these little, like, I guess we call them pet projects. They have this like list of websites, and they stuff them in these censorship events, and then those websites go down. So, and this pattern of collateral damage you can find in other instances of Google. So I wrote a Medium article that I posted on my Twitter account at Perpetual Maniac, detailing how insiders could have taken down Tulsi Gabbard's ad account. And the reason why I know how this works is because I saw how insiders were able to take down Jordan B. Peterson's account. And the way that they're able to do this is that let's say there's a target address. So let's say Jordan Peterson, and then someone takes his address and creates a spam account that differs by one letter, right? So maybe they spell Jordan with two N's. And they repeat this process until there's a spam network, a bot network of similar spam accounts to the original target account. Now they start pushing spam out to a bunch of other accounts. Well, the Google AI will flag that as suspicious activity and bring down the whole spam network, but they'll also bring down the target email address. And this is the thing that's really strange. And so when the person's like, why did my account get suspended? you know, especially if they're an influencer. And Google will respond, well, it seems like your account had suspicious activity, right? And now the person, you know, they can't talk to a human. They have no idea what's happening, and their account just goes down. They lost everything inside of it, you know? And Jordan Peterson was able to get his account back because there was a network of people complaining to Google, like, hey, this guy's account has been taken down. And so, you know, there's a human intervention. They go, oh, wow, looks like someone's making a bunch of accounts. But that information never makes it back to the public. So the public never knows that there's this vulnerability. And the cycle just continues on and on and on and on and on. And Google refuses to fix it. And the question I have is, why doesn't Google want to fix this? And, you know, that gets into conspiracies about what's really going on with the company. But I've noticed that this pattern of collateral damage exists across several different platforms and several different modalities.
Yeah, I was just about to get into that, actually. I mean, well, Facebook talks about its coordinated inauthentic behavior, which it's used to deplatform hundreds of political pages in the run-up to elections. And Wikipedia also does the same thing. I mean, the Wikipedia smear is famous for, they say, oh, it's not us smearing this person, it's these editors. Oh, if you know, you want to, anybody can edit. Yeah, you just try to edit a political page about an important event that's going on now. It's impossible.
It's impossible. So, they closed the gates. They shut it off. Now you can't challenge the Wikipedia article. And now they're rewriting all the articles in a really like creepy Orwellian sense. They're rewriting history. And now you get, now, effectively, Wikipedia is a laundering for slander, you know? And so Google calls it vandalism. Oh, Wikipedia's been vandalized, right? And it's kind of ridiculous because that vandalism gets ingested by its AI algorithms, and then it starts leaking out into, you know, the larger Google search engine. So I remember there was a time when you could search for California Republican, and Google returned back a bunch of structured results. And one of the results was, you know, the ideology, and it listed it as like Nazi. It's like they have a Nazi ideology.
Yeah, I remember that.
And people are like, oh, how can this happen? And I on the inside saw that it was because they were ingesting the data from Wikipedia under the ideology tag, and someone knew that they could put Nazism under that ideology tag and would go all the way. They have right access all the way to the search engine. And so what did Google did? They're like, oh, well, let's just, you know, not take in, you know, the ideology tag from Wikipedia anymore. And that's how it works.
Yeah, putting a Band-Aid on a gaping bullet wound. I mean, how closely do Google and Wikipedia work as far as, like, the Google takes content for knowledge boxes and YouTube takes content for these conspiracy theory boxes that it puts under videos about 9/11 and whatnot? Like, how closely do the two websites coordinate, do you know?
From a couple of data points, it appears to me that they do it quite closely. There was one weird Google search weirdness that people are familiar with in the conspiracy circles, and that's if you go into Google and you type in American scientists or American inventors, right? So, you know, up to 1960, 90% of America was white. So you would expect that since most of American history has been predominantly white, that most of the results would be predominantly white as well for, you know, who are American scientists have been, just by the fact that they dominate in sheer numbers. Now, Google's results return, you know, when you search for that term American scientist, it returns a list predominantly focused on African Americans. And same for, you know, so that exists for American scientists, and that exists for American inventors. And so I started to dig in, like, well, why is it? Why is this the case? And it turns out it's Wikipedia.
Oh, okay. How is Wikipedia doing that?
I don't have it up in front of me, but they've listed African American. You know, so you know, there's this assumption that African American are always, you know, black people, which is really ridiculous because I've got a really good friend from South Africa and she's white. But so they've listed these people under African Americans. And so what happens is that when someone types in American scientists or American inventors, what it's doing is it's grabbing from that, it's keyword matching to the list African Americans and putting that information out there. And so it's over reporting for African Americans. Now, okay, so that's a mistake. And if Google was to be made aware of this mistake, they would fix it, right? Well, no, that's not what happened. You know, there's an email thread that I included in the disclosure of someone, you saw that, and someone's complaining, hey, like this is giving us really bad press. You know, can we fix this? And the response to that is, hey, you know, we've got this program called ProFair. We're trying to bring fairness to the internet, and ProFair is part of ML Fairness. And they said this is part of ProFair, so you know this is just collateral damage. And they didn't fix it at all. And this is the problem: is that not only are these results getting poisoned, but when this poisoning has been brought to the attention of Google, they're willingly turning a blind eye, and they're not trying to fix it. And once you take all these data points together, put them together and connect the dots, you start getting the sinister picture of a company that is trying to, you know, institute an overthrow of the American system for some global communist, you know, conspiracy. And I hate to say the word conspiracy, but if you're going to apply Occam's razor to all of this, it's pretty clear that the same people that feed narratives into the New York Times are the same people that are feeding narratives into Google. You know, the only other thing you conclude is that it's just a total coincidence that all this stuff happens at the same time. You know, and so I don't believe that. I believe in logic and reason, and it's clear after watching this company for 3 years under a microscope that they're engaged in some sort of nefarious conspiracy that, you know, is being decided above the CEO level.
And about the diversity versus the purpose of the search engine, there was one document that said that, oh, it would be a bad thing if the search results that were returned were the most popular search results. Now, wasn't that the whole point of Google to begin with? I mean,
right
back when it first started, I mean,
I think
really
this came under
weird.
The definition of algorithmic unfairness. They're trying to like figure out like what would be like unfair. And what they said is that, I think they used the example of like a CEO. So, you know, if someone searched for CEO and the results that were returned were mostly male, they said that even if this reflected objective reality, it could still be classified as algorithmic unfairness and that we should intervene via product intervention. So there you go. Like, reality is unfair. Objective reality is unfair, and they're going to redefine it because they think that, you know, we can be programmed and that by fixing people that they're going to create a better and more equitable and just society. That's their words, not mine.
Yep, and they speak quite openly about programming people. I mean, that's some of it they say, okay, we don't want to put this in print, but some of it they say, well, yeah, we program, this is how neural networks work, and we have to take advantage of this. And the exact quote that I was looking for is, suppose Google favors pages most linked to clicked on. That's the whole point of Google. I mean, that's when it first started. That was the whole point of Google.
Right.
I mean, yeah, I have a bunch of details that I guess we don't have time to if you have to go in 15 minutes, but there's a bunch of other stuff that I want to get to. So basically, this equality of opportunity, like that they've given up on making search their focus, and now it's making diversity their focus again. Like, the shareholders would seem to have a problem with this. Like, they put all of their energy, they put all their money into picking through the coffee beans, that weird document that compares people to different types of coffee beans.
So weird. It's like, wow. And they even say in the document, hey, don't save this because this could be really damaging to us later on.
Yeah, it's like they don't want it to get out. And I was wondering, like, I mean, it seems like Google's kind of a cult. They have their own language. They have very secretive with all of the layers and layers of non-disclosure agreements. Like, now, if they're a cult, is there a holy text? I heard there was a woman giving a speech about algorithmic unfairness, and she mentioned a book about something about moral psychology, Jonathan Haidt or something like that. Is there like a holy text of Google, or is it just a religion?
Yeah, well, they've had an indoctrination program for a while, and what they did is they had all the employees register for this class called Implicit Association Test. And this AIT test was developed at Stanford, and it was later outed as pseudoscience by the Wall Street Journal. But what it did is it was a challenge response test. So they give you – they flash things on a screen, and then you have to, like, click a certain button. What that test does is it measures how internally racist the employee is, and then they give you a score, and they say, well, we're not going to send the score to your manager, so it's okay. And my understanding about that is that they were kind of priming the employees to think of themselves as inherently racist and biased. And then the solution to that was that Google would introduce this this machine learning fairness to get rid of all the different biases. But here's the problem, is that if you have the whole set of human biases, right, it forms this circle. Let's say there's like 100, and that's about a close number. But let's say there's 100 identified human biases. What Google did is they only chose 13 of those. And this is a problem, because that means that if they only define the set of biases as this subset, then anything that is not part of that subset is by definition not something that they're solving fairness for, which means that all of those other biases are now attack vectors that you can use to inject bias into the machine learning algorithms. So, you know, it's you know, when there's like this huge castle that's built on a foundation, you know, and there's like walls and there's ramparts and, you know, there's a lot of people like manning it. People are like, oh, how do we, you know, break the walls down, you know? And that's the wrong point of attack. When something is fundamentally flawed, it's flawed right at the foundation. And so you can just skip the walls, you can skip the windows, you can skip all the people of, you know, presumed credibility that defend it. You just go right to the foundation. And the papers that I've disclosed show the weakness, and they show the bias, and they show that they are deliberately classifying a handpicked selection of biases that they're going to solve for. And they're going to say that all the other biases they aren't. And that's the weakness of this, is that, you know, this shouldn't be called machine learning fairness. This should be called machine learning unfairness.
Yes, selective unfairness.
Right, because the output is unfair. Like, you go to, you know, the search engine and you search for, you know, men can, and it's auto-completing for men can have babies, men can have periods as its top results. That's not rational. That's not fair. That's a clown world, and it needs to be called out as a clown world. And it doesn't just extend to cultural events. It also goes on into the political spectrum. So if you go, you know, Trump body, you know, it's going to autocomplete to body count. And then you go to Hillary Clinton body, you know, you put it C, it's not going to give you any search prediction. And there's been so many people that have died around Hillary Clinton. And a lot of people may still think it's a conspiracy, but I think most of the people have woken up at this point. There are so many people that have died. I think it's like 45 to 60 people have died around Hillary Clinton under very mysterious, you know, causes. And I think one guy was, you know, he died with two gunshot wounds to the back of the head. And the police declared it, maybe, and the police declared that it was a suicide.
And yeah, nobody has 45 dead friends. That's how I always put it.
Yeah.
I mean.
So, that's what they consider algorithmic fairness. So, yeah, I call BS on that, and that's just why I disclosed, is because, you know, Google's entire, you know, operating procedures to dox Americans and sell it to, you know, ad exchanges, and I just turned the tables on them. You know, Patriots on the Inside doxing Google, and so that's our disclosure.
That was one of the things I wanted to ask about. Like, can they be stopped, or are they too closely integrated with the government? Because Google basically is the CIA at this point. They host all their servers and stuff, and they're so closely integrated with the Pentagon, although they say that they're not. I mean, you work with Google Earth, you know that Google Earth started as a CIA project called Keyhole. So,
right.
I mean,
funded by Intel.
Yep. Yep.
Can they be stopped? I think that they will be stopped. The weak point of evil is that you just have to shine a spotlight on it. And once everyone sees the absolute circus that exists, then it kind of collapses on its own. And so I think that the first step of this, of defeating Google, is to disclose what they're doing. You know, and you see, you know, Trump directing a lawsuit just this morning to Google for its 2016 election meddling. And that's a first step, is acknowledging and getting all of that information out there and getting court cases, to acknowledge and rule that, yes, in fact, they did. The evidence is overwhelming. So that's like the first step. What comes after that is going to be up to the think tanks. It's going to be up to the industry. I think that this is a watershed moment. I think that there's a real coming together of left and right. And what we're noticing is that Google is censoring both of us.
Yes.
And the thing is that this is a bipartisan moment for us to figure out what we're going to do about that. And I think that if there's this much illegal activity that Google has been involved in, then what else are they involved in? And I think that what's going to happen is that as this gets investigated and all of these illicit activities come to the light, that Google is essentially going to collapse by the weight of its own illegal activity.
I mean, I would like to see Google collapse under the weight of its own evil and of its own misdeeds, but I don't know. I mean, it seems like they basically have us all by the throat, and I don't know. I mean, it's pretty scary. I mean, how do we protect ourselves from Google basically selling our deepest secrets if we step out of line? Like, I mean, you have had your own smear job with the Daily Beast coming out and saying all this stuff about you, getting you basically blacklisted from mainstream, even more enlightened networks like the one that I work for don't want to go near you because of that smear job. So, I mean, that happens to basically anybody who steps out of line. How do we protect ourselves from that?
Right. So, you know, this is something I've been giving a lot of thought, because I'm kind of like on the run from Google right now, and I've realized that everything that I do, every email that I send, half the phones that I text message are Google products. And therefore, they have access to that data firsthand. And so what I've been doing is I've been engaging in a Google detox, where I stop using their products, I stop using Google search, and I start using StartPage and DuckDuckGo. I've changed my browsers, I've deleted Chrome, and I've switched to the Brave browser and Firefox. Although Firefox seems to be heading down the same road that Google is.
Firefox is not good.
And the Tor browser. I still use Twitter because it seems to be not going down the same clown road that Google is going down. But, you know, and then for email, I've switched from Gmail to ProtonMail. And actually, ProtonMail seems to be a much better experience than the Gmail is. What else, right? Like, a lot of the content is still hosted on YouTube, but there seems to be a mobilization of people as they're moving to BitChute and Mines and other, you know, video services. And so right now what I see is that people are waking up, they're realizing what the situation is, and they're engaging in a Google detox strategy. And actually, having gone through this, I thought it was going to be really bad, but it turns out it's actually really good. It feels good to give my support to people that respect user privacy rather than violate it.
Yeah, okay. Other thing is Google, they've said that having multiple search results is basically a bug. They want to have one search result. Basically, that's where this voice-activated computing is going towards. And that's where I see it converging with Wikipedia, because the first Google search result is usually Wikipedia. How far away would you say that that is, that basically we are looking at one search result and it's brought to you by Google and it's Wikipedia?
At this point, that timeline is no longer possible. I can't see that it can exist in any foreseeable future. There's just too many people that are awake right now. And so, yeah, I don't think there's just going to be one result. I think they wanted to put one result. Yeah, that's not going to happen anymore. Because if it does, we're just going to go use a different search engine.
I hope you're right. I hope there are enough people who actually are awake enough to realize how evil this stuff is that's breathing down our neck. And we hear about these Google Assistant and these Amazon Alexas that are spying on us, everything, and we're told that everybody's got one, but I personally don't know anybody who has these things who would invite them into their homes. And I think that a lot of this is this projection that this is normal, that this is, nobody cares about privacy anymore, but in reality people actually do, and nobody wants to have this. I mean, basically the merger of corporate and state is called fascism. I mean, people hold up Trump as being the epitome of fascism, but that's totally a distraction. Trump is meaningless in the grand scheme of things. It's corporations and government. All right. Well, actually, there was one other thing I did want to ask. That would be a nice
What's
end
that?
To finish on. But this whole the censorship thing is being aided and abetted by these groups that claim to be against hate speech and claim to be for marginalized groups, groups like the ADL, groups like the SPLC. How closely does Google interface with those? Like, have they got people in there, or is it just they happen to be? Because I know that the ADL was for a while working on one of these algorithms to basically detect quote unquote hate before it actually is put out there, basically stopping messages before they're posted, that sort of thing. How closely is Google involved with that, with this Jigsaw perspective API, stuff like that?
Pretty close. You know, Google had big contracts with the ADL and the SLPC to police their content. They've jettisoned those people recently, but they've had their hands in a lot of Google's machine learning fairness algorithms. And it's really sad because the ADL says they're anti-defamation league, but in fact, they operate as a defamation organization. And the Southern Law Poverty Center does the same thing. They don't prevent hate. They engage in it by listing. I mean, the SLPC lists Christian Identity as a hate organization, you know? And so you see how creepy this is. Like, if the phrase Christian Identity is, you know, a hate phrase, then because some random group that was probably made by the deep state, you know, called themselves that. Now, all of a sudden, if someone goes on Twitter or, you know, webpage and say, I identify as Christian, well, that's so close to that they can now be flagged. And so these groups have been involved with a lot of Google services. They were involved in Jigsaw. I don't know the specifics of that because I didn't work on that project, but they've been dropped, and I'm really happy. As far as I know, they've both been dropped from Google, and that's a step in the right direction, but we can't stop there.
And just the Wikipedia thing with Wikipedia can determine what is and is not a reliable source. Does Google rely on Wikipedia for its ratings of news organizations, or how do they get, because I saw like numbered, like the Wall Street Journal was up at the top and InfoWars was at the bottom and then everybody else was somewhere in between with numbers. Where do they get those numbers?
I mean, it's so disgusting that the Washington Post is considered a credible news organization at this point, you know.
Yeah.
And it's funny, just go off on a small tangent. I was told by a prominent left wing influencer that James O'Keefe was not credible, and it's just like he's never ever had to retract a story, you know. And to think that James O'Keefe and Project Veritas are not considered by the influential left as credible, but the New York Times is mind-boggling. So I don't think that they have to even go to Wikipedia. My understanding is that their rank of credibility is done internally, and that what they started to realize is that that is a liability, so they've been farming it out to third parties like the ADL and SLPC. So, but don't quote me on that. That's just a theory. So.
Okay. Is there anything in particular that you really want to get out there that you haven't yet said, or that you think people really need to know?
Yeah. So, I encourage your audience to come and look me up on Twitter as Perpetual Maniac. Your retweets are what's keeping me alive. There's a lot of whistleblowers that have come out and said, you know, hey, the lifespan of a whistleblower is pretty short. So the only way you can survive is to stay in the spotlight. And if I stay in the spotlight, then I'm going to be fine. If I go into the shadows, then I become vulnerable. So, you know, for the audience, like, I am on a mission of truth and justice, and I'm exposing Google, and I ask that they come and help me spread the message and spread the truth. And because we're going to take this beast down, I'm fighting dragons, and they're weak right now. And there's other titans that are lining up to take them down with me. And so I ask your audience to help join the fight, and together we can make a difference in a safer America.
Very interesting interview. Thank you very much, Helen.
Thanks.
And I look forward to sharing more on our next program, everyone. Have a nice day.
There's too many of you crying.